Our Enemies in Blue, Police and Power in America by Christian Williams. This is the first of two parts of Chapter 7, entitled Secret Police, Red Squads, and the Strategy of Permanent Repression. Police intervention during industrial strife has had a complex legacy, producing detailed riot control strategies and specialized units to handle political intelligence. Judging by appearances, one might not think that these two sets of activities have very much to do with each other. Riot cops wear full protective gear and operate in ways that are by definition very public. The stereotypical trench coat aside, police spies usually wear no uniforms at all, and their activities are often covert. The targets are generally unaware of police intelligence activity, and the public at large barely recognizes its existence. But historically, Red Squads were formed with crowd control in mind, and took on their secret police functions later. Separate divisions currently handle these duties, but their operations remain connected at the root. The riot cop and the secret policeman provide two faces of political repression. Haymarket, anarchy is on trial. The role of police in crushing dissent and the place of intelligence work within that pursuit began to take shape in 1886 in response to the movement for an 8-hour workday. In May of that year, the nation saw a wave of strikes demanding 8 hours for work, 8 hours for sleep, 8 hours for what you will. Much of the action was centered in Chicago, where on May 1, 40,000 workers walked off the job, and were joined a few days later by 25,000 more. On May 3, police shot and killed 4 workers picketing the McCormick Harvester Works. Enraged, August spies, an anarchist, printed a forceful handbill calling for an open-air meeting on May 4 in Haymarket Square. The flyer was headed Working Men to Arms, and encouraged workers to come prepared to defend themselves. The rally began as a typical affair. 3,000 people came to listen to speeches, but as the evening wore on and storm clouds gathered, their numbers dwindled to just a few hundred. At last, when the final speaker was on stage, 180 police appeared and ordered the crowd to disperse. In response, someone from the crowd, it has never been determined who, threw a bomb into the line of police. 76 cops were injured, 7 later died. The police immediately opened fire, killing about a dozen of the crowd and injuring 200 more, as well as hitting some of their own. The Haymarket bomb cost the 8-hour movement dearly, dividing the radicals from their natural base of support, unionists, and setting off the first serious Red Scare in American history. On May 5 and 6, police under the leadership of Captain Michael J. Shack made more than 50 raids against newspaper offices, union halls, and other radical meeting spots. State Attorney Julius Grinnell urged the cops, quote, make the raids first and look up the law afterwards, unquote. Shack apparently decided not to bother with the law at all. His published notes detailed 70 interrogations conducted during this period. They were revealed that prisoners had been denied lawyers, food, water, and medical treatment. Meanwhile, around the country, state legislatures hurriedly passed laws limiting the rights of labor unions, and courts began convicting strikers en masse. This climate of political repression lasted well into the 1890s. Of those arrested, 8 anarchists were charged with murder. August Spies, Albert Parsons, Adolf Fischer, Samuel Felden, Michael Schwab, Louis Ling, Oscar Niebe, and George Engel. While it was never learned who threw the bomb, it was certainly none of these men. Most of them weren't even at Haymarket. Those who were there were on the speaker's platform, in plain sight. Nevertheless, after a highly irregular and explicitly political trial, all 8 were convicted and 7 were sentenced to hang. Niebe was sentenced to 15 years. The tool for convicting innocent men of a capital offense was the claim that they had urged others to violence and were therefore responsible for the violence that occurred. The prosecutor had originally sought to prove that the defendants had executed the bombing themselves. Failing that, he resorted to a theory that they had conspired together to kill policemen, crafting a plot carried out by another unknown person. But there was no evidence for any such plot. So instead, the case came to rely on the allegation that the person who threw the bomb had been driven to do so by the defendant's anarchistic writings and fiery speeches. Over the objections of the defense, the prosecutor read aloud the fiercest anarchist writings he could lay his hands on. Some of these were written by the defendants, others were not. Nobody paid much attention to such details, as the purpose of this evidence was purely prejudicial. State Attorney Julius Grinnell put it this way as he addressed the jury. Quote, "Law is on trial. Anarchy is on trial. These men have been selected, picked out by the grand jury, and indicted because they were leaders. They're no more guilty than the thousands who follow them. Gentlemen of the jury, convict these men, make examples of them, and you save our institutions, our society." Unquote. That it was anarchy on trial, Albert Parsons agreed. He wrote to a friend, quote, "There is no evidence that I or any of us killed or had anything to do with the killing of policemen at the Haymarket. None at all. But it was proven clearly that we were, all of us, anarchists, socialists, communists, knights of labor, unionists. It was proven that three of us were editors of labor papers, that five of us were labor organizers and speakers at working men's mass meetings. They, this class, court, jury, law, and verdict, have decided that we must be put to death because, as they say, we are leaders of men who denounce and battle against the oppression, slavery, robbery, and influences of the monopolists. Of these crimes against the capitalist class, they found us guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, and, so finding, they have sentenced us." Unquote. Parsons' spies, Fisher and Engel, eventually did hang. Ling committed suicide while awaiting execution. The survivors first had their sentences commuted to life imprisonment, and 6 years later were pardoned by Governor John Altgeld. Altgeld made it clear in issuing his pardon that he did so because, quote, "much of the evidence given at the trial was a pure fabrication," unquote. Unfortunately, Haymarket established the pattern that anti-radical campaigns would follow for the century to come. The basic elements are present. In a climate of conflict and political polarization, an incident of dubious origin provides the pretext for suppressing radical movements. Raids, arrests, and media smear campaigns lead up to a criminal trial, at which the defendant's political views and associations are presented as evidence. The authorities involved in the Haymarket affair, Captain Shack especially, pioneered the use of radical hunting as a means of building a career, consolidating power, and lining one's pockets at the same time. Shack used his position for shameless self-promotion, casting himself as a first-class sleuth, bragging about conspiracies he had supposedly unearthed and plots he had foiled, and even writing a book on the matter, Anarchy and Anarchists. On top of this, Shack gained control of a slush fund established by the conservative Chicago Citizens Association, and used its resources to bribe witnesses, hire informers, and pay for other related investigative expenses. In addition to this considerable sum, it was later revealed that he had, on more than one occasion, personally accepted bribes and helped himself to a great deal of the evidence seized in raids. Shack quickly became dependent on the role he had created for himself, the great anarchist hunter. To justify continued operations, he began creating the conspiracies he was to uncover. In 1889, Police Chief Frederick Ebersold told the Chicago Times, quote, "Captain Shack wanted to keep things stirring. He wanted bombs to be found here, there, all around, everywhere. I thought people would lie down to sleep better if they were not afraid their homes would be blown to pieces any minute. But this man, Shack, wanted none of that policy. After we got the anarchist societies broken up, Shack wanted to send out people to organize new societies right away. He wanted to keep the thing boiling, keep himself prominent before the public." Unquote. Haymarket was not the first police excursion into the realm of political spying, but it did signify the beginning of a new trend. Quote, "The Haymarket tragedy marked the emergence of a new form of policing. Anarchists were indiscriminately surveilled, not only as a means of crime suppression, but for ideological reasons alone. This style of ideological warfare against anarchism broke ground for subsequent similar police investigations against socialism and communism." Unquote. Repression 101. There's nothing surprising about the antagonism between anarchists and authorities. Anarchists oppose the powerful and the institutions that maintain their power, especially the state. They don't like bosses, bureaucrats, politicians, landlords, or cops. And, for the most part, the feeling is mutual. The state's reaction to such opposition is equally unsurprising. It is the nature of power to preserve itself, and this requires that efforts to change the structures of society be actively opposed by those who profit from the existing order. Quote, "Repression is a process by which those in power try to keep themselves in power by consciously attempting to destroy or render harmless organizations and ideologies that threaten that power." Unquote. Repression may be accomplished through propaganda, indoctrination, and other ideological means, or, when these fail, through more direct means like harassment, imprisonment, and violence. More specifically, quote, political repression in the context of policing may be defined as police behavior motivated or influenced in whole or in part by hostility to protest, dissent, and related activities perceived as a threat to the status quo, unquote. In addition to the means listed above, repression may involve a much broader range of both overt and covert activities, including surveillance, false arrest, media smear campaigns, the use of disinformation, burglary, blackmail, infiltration, sabotage, the promotion of factionalism, entrapment, threats, brutality, assassinations, and torture. The form repression takes and the intensity with which it is applied will depend on a variety of factors, including the aims of the target group, its popularity, its strengths and weaknesses, its methods, and the goals, popularity, and relative strength or vulnerability of the government. But whatever its shape, the purpose of repression remains essentially the same. Based on his experience is in Northern Ireland, Kenya, Cyprus, and elsewhere in the crumbling British Empire, military strategist Frank Kitson described the task facing a government when rebellion surfaces. Quote, translated into normal terms, the aim of the government is to regain, if necessary, and then retain the allegiance of the population, and for this purpose it must eliminate those involved in subversion. But in order to eliminate the subversive party and its unarmed and armed supporters, it must gain control of the population. Unquote. Repression is a tricky business, and it is complicated by the fact that the initiative seems to always rest with the subversives. Rebellions may brew, discontent spread, revolutionaries prepare their forces, all before the government even realizes it is facing a threat. Intelligence work is intended to fill this gap. The Senate Select Committee to Study Government Operations with Respect to Intelligence Activities, the Church Committee, outlines three types of intelligence activities. Quote, the first is intelligence collection, such as infiltrating groups with informants, wiretapping, or opening letters. The second is dissemination of material which has been collected. The third is covert action designed to disrupt and discredit the activities of groups and individuals deemed a threat to the social order. These three types of intelligence activity are closely related in the practical world. Information which is disseminated by the intelligence community or used in disruptive programs has usually been obtained through surveillance. Unquote. Furthermore, the same techniques may be used for more than one goal simultaneously. Surveillance has its obvious uses in collecting information, but conspicuous surveillance may also be used to harass the target, breed paranoia and feelings of persecution, and so on. Likewise, informants can supply information, and they can also be used to disrupt a group's organizing efforts, engaging in routine sabotage, provoking rivalries and infighting, and encouraging illegal, especially violent, activities that can discredit the organization. The specific strategies and techniques involved have been developed over time, with the 20th century representing a period of particular progress. The degree of actual activity has ebbed and flowed, for the most part following the level of dissident political activity, particularly dissent from the left. At the national level, this work has been centered in the federal intelligence agencies, the FBI, the CIA, Army Intelligence, but has also come to involve, at times, practically every federal agency and every branch of government. At the local level, the bulk of intelligence work has been shared between the police and innumerable private agencies, beginning with the Pinkertons. Within police departments, the branches responsible for keeping the lid on subversives have gone under a wide variety of names, including Radical Bureau, the Anarchist Squad, the Bomb Squad, the Intelligence Division, the Industrial Squad, the Bureau of Special Services, the Special Investigations Bureau, and others. For the sake of regularity, I will refer to them here primarily under the generic term Red Squad. The Red Squads. New York City's Red Squad got a head start on the rest of the country. On January 13, 1874, in what came to be termed the Tompkins Square Riot, 7,000 people took to the streets in a demonstration against unemployment, and the police responded by ruthlessly beating them. Following that debacle, the police department began assigning detectives to spy on socialist and union meetings. Within just a few years, their operations expanded enormously. In 1895 and 1896, the NYPD tapped 350 phones, including those of churches. This pattern was repeated in cities around the United States. The police began by attacking public events, especially demonstrations. They rigorously enforced laws, forcibly dispersed crowds, and expended a great deal of energy trying to identify and nab individual agitators who they assumed must be responsible for any such disturbance. This latter pursuit quickly developed to the point where police targeted entire organizations, sending informants to their meetings. The creation of special branches devoted to this task took hold after 1900, prompted by labor unrest, the increased popularity of socialism, and a wave of immigration. The role of the Red Squads further expanded during World War I, thanks in part to Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer and his curious notion of national security. Local cops aided the Justice Department first in 1917 with a series of raids against the industrial workers of the world. IWW headquarters were raided in 11 cities, and hundreds of union leaders were arrested, allegedly for interfering with the draft. The Red Squads repeated their performance 2 years later, beginning in 1919, as they provided support for Justice Department raids on a wide range of leftist organizations, resulting in 4,000 arrests and almost 1,000 deportations. Local police agencies found support for these endeavors among the members of the American Protective League, a volunteer organization formed during the war to combat espionage and sabotage, round up draft dodgers, and spy on immigrants. Many APL volunteers were actually off-duty cops. Others were deputized to assist in the raids. During this same period, laws regulating demonstrations, meetings, and leafleting granted the police broad powers to determine when, where, and what speech would be allowed. It thus became the explicit function of the police to suppress the free exercise of political speech. As the Great Depression produced a swell of activism and unrest, police practices shifted toward a focus on intelligence operations rather than direct intervention. Intelligence became a distinct pursuit, very nearly its own profession, increasingly removed from law enforcement. While the potential for such a division had been present as early as 1886, it became institutionalized during the 1930s as Red Squads paid less attention to public disorder and more to the organizations and movements behind such discord. This change in emphasis was accompanied by a marked escalation in tactics. Increasing numbers of informants were employed against an ever wider array of organizations. The most spectacular abuses, of course, were those directed from the top. During the 1930s, Los Angeles's Red Squad had been used to target the mayor's critics and political opponents, even to the point of outright blackmail. At the same time, active disruption of organizations became a higher priority, often greatly overreaching the authority granted the police, and even directly violating the law. For instance, the head of the Los Angeles Red Squad, Captain Earl Kynut, was convicted and imprisoned in connection with a 1938 car bomb explosion that critically injured a member of a reform group, the Citizens Independent Investigating Committee, which had been leading a campaign against police corruption, an effort certain to draw the ire of the authorities. Kynut's zealotry led not only to a prison term, but to the dissolution of his squad as well. Shortly after his conviction, the city council eliminated its funding. Elsewhere in the country, Red Squads fell victim to their own success. In the conservative climate of the 1950s, they faced a repeat of Captain Schlack's problem, a shortage of subversives. The response to this situation was twofold. In part, Red Squads focused again on their historical opponents, labor unions. At the time, they were granted a new mission as auxiliary forces in the Cold War. But while the FBI still relied on local police for a great deal of information, the special units saw their numbers and resources dwindle. As a result, Red Squads became increasingly isolated within local departments, and their activities became even more removed from regular police work. The upheavals of the 60s and 70s made police spying a priority again, but did nothing to reverse the federalization of intelligence, the specialization of Red Squad operations, or their organizational culture, and its distance from other police, not to mention the citizenry. Instead, as police were continually called on to suppress what seemed to be ever-growing social movements, these characteristics only solidified. As the role of Red Squads expanded and the number of officers involved grew, the flaws, faults, and excesses of intelligence agencies, perhaps of intelligence per se, increased in magnitude and became more readily apparent. a renaissance of repression. During the 1960s, in city after city, Red Squads suddenly swelled like an unpleasant fungus. Detroit's intelligence unit had only 6 members at the end of the 1950s. By 1968, that number had grown to 70. In most places, the rate of growth was most astonishing at the very end of the decade. Between 1968 and 1970, the New York City Red Squad went from 68 uniformed officers to 90, plus 55 others assigned to undercover work. During the same period, Los Angeles increased its Red Squad from 84 officers to 167. The Chicago Police Department had 500 intelligence officers at the end of the decade, and Illinois State Police Superintendent James T. McGuire estimated that more than 1,000 federal, state, and local operatives were working in the area undercover. As the popular movements developed, first the civil rights movement, then student movements, anti-war efforts, and a host of others, the police understanding of these campaigns, their objectives, and the conditions producing them seriously lagged. The police response, as though from habit, was to blame a conspiracy and seek out the agitators creating all this turmoil. Hence, identification procedures retained their central place in the strategy of repression, and photography became a sort of obsession. As with infiltration, wiretapping, and the collection of dossiers, photography was easily exploited as a means of intimidation, as well as data gathering. At times, intimidation became the primary function of police photography. Cops would take numerous pictures at close range, or alternately, show their subject photographs of herself when she hadn't realized she was under surveillance. Conspicuous surveillance was often accompanied by other forms of harassment as well, including slashed tires, verbal abuse, and arbitrary arrests. As the role of surveillance was extended, the number and type of subjects increased as well. By the end of the 1960s, many Red Squads were building straightforward enemies lists, going after people outside of any radical movement. For example, after the 1968 Democratic Convention, the Chicago police maintained files on churches and members of the clergy, newspaper columnists and radio commentators, an ACLU attorney, the League of Women Voters, the Parent Teacher Association, the chair of Sears and Roebuck, the president of Notre Dame University, state's attorney Bernard M. Carey, prosecuting attorney Barnabas Sears, Dan Walker, author of the Walker Report on the 1968 Democratic Convention and later governor, U.S. Senator Charles Percy, 7 sitting or former aldermen, 15 members of the Illinois General Assembly, the chair of the First National Bank, Chicago Bears running back Gale Sayers, and Congressional Representative Ralph Metcalf. A few years later, Philadelphia Mayor Frank Rizzo created a special 33-member intelligence unit, answerable directly to him. The unit's sole purpose was to investigate 2 of Rizzo's political adversaries, City Councilor Peter J. Canyell and City Council President George X. Schwartz. As the range of targets grew, so did the range of tactics, first to improve surveillance and then, as is the pattern, to harass leaders, cripple organizations, and interfere with their political efforts. Wiretaps and mail opening came very much into fashion during this period. As in the 30s, informers were employed in increasing numbers with a key difference. Whereas previously infiltration was done primarily by private detectives or civilian volunteers, in the 1960s it became the norm to use police officers themselves. Interestingly, the specialization of undercover work did nothing to abate the agent's development from passive observer to saboteur, and then from saboteur to provocateur. In fact, informers often suggested the plans, supplied the weapons, drove the car, and then made the arrest. ACLU attorney Frank Donner observes, quote, "The most common provocateur is simply a professional police agent who coldly engineers a single provocative act designed to set up leaders for roundup and arrest," unquote. An infiltrator's success didn't always rely on discrediting an organization or bringing legal action against them. For example, in 1967, the New York Police Department sent Richard Lyons, a civilian, into the Veterans and Reservists Against the War, VNR. During the 2 years he was a member, he advocated the VNR attack soldiers with tear gas, burned GI weapons authorization cards, a federal offense, charge police lines during demonstrations, and carry replica machine guns. Each suggestion was firmly rejected in favor of legal and nonviolent tactics. Nevertheless, when he was finally exposed in 1968, The knowledge that they had been infiltrated greatly added to feelings of demoralization and contributed to the VNR's collapse. In part, the work of infiltrators represented a move away from the reactive practices and toward a proactive, anticipatory approach. Hence, Red Squads justified many of their activities with the claim that they were necessary in order to prevent violence. On the contrary, infiltrators often encouraged violence, as the VNR case shows. And the Red Squad's methods carried with them inherent barriers to law enforcement. For example, information gathered illegally was usually inadmissible in court, and the reluctance to identify informants greatly limited their utility in actual prosecutions. Add to this the fact that so much of the information police gathered was hopelessly off base. One Chicago cop told a Cook County grand jury that he listed as a member of an organization anyone who attended two of its first public meetings. This information was passed on to the FBI and disseminated from there. More recently, in 2002, files leaked to activist groups revealed that the Denver Police Department had used the label criminal extremist as a default category when no other description seemed to apply. Featured under this heading were political activists, members of the clergy, troubled students, and, for some reason, people who had received honors from the department itself. A commission appointed by the mayor determined that none of the 3,400 files could be legitimately maintained and ordered them destroyed. But the files and their inaccuracies had already been passed on to other agencies. The harm of such exaggeration is multiplied as misinformation is spread from one agency to others. For example, in 1973, the Seattle Police Department's Intelligence Division opened a file on a local Chicano activist. The American Friends Service Committee described the report's transformation as it changed hands. Quote, it began, quote, modus operandi, participant in demonstrations supporting UFWX Safeway, SICK, establishment of El Centro, unquote. His only police record is for failure to disperse during a demonstration. By 1976, however, in describing him to the Portland Police Intelligence Division, Seattle Police stated, quote, M.O. Chicano activist advocates terrorist acts, unquote. There's no information in the SPD intelligence files to support such a defamatory and damaging claim, unquote. Inaccuracies and distortions are phenomena familiar to anyone who reads even standard police reports, but the potential for misreporting is amplified by the nature of undercover work, especially when informants are paid for the information. Quote, both the pressures and inducements, along with the sense of guilt that required the betrayer to find some justification for his betrayal, tend to produce tainted information. All too frequently, it is inaccurate, highly selective, and based on sinister and unwarranted interferences. Where a literal version of a target's utterances would seem innocent, the informer will insist on stressing the connotations. Conversely, where the language is figurative or metaphysical, sick, the informer reports it as literally intended. Most important of all, he seizes on the transient fantasies of the powerless, rhetoric and images not intended to be acted upon, and transforms them into conspiracies whose purpose and commitment are wholly alien to their volatile and ambiguous context. Unquote. These interpretive practices underscore the symbolic value of Red Squad files. At first a simple administrative tool for collecting and organizing evidence, these files, like so much in the field of intelligence, quickly became a means of intimidation and eventually became an end in themselves, serving to legitimize the Red Squad's other activities. More often than not, the reported violence was only a much exaggerated pretext for heavier repression. Frank Donner describes the pattern as it appeared in Philadelphia. Quote, based on information typically supplied by a street tipster or casual informant or discovered through several weeks of intensive surveillance by the CD, the Civil Disobedience Unit, police would raid a private residence where they assertedly found explosive guns or inflammatory literature. A torrent of Rizzo-inspired publicity would then link the raided premises and the seized material to a group of militants, which it usually suggested was part of a larger and more powerful movement. Front page stories, under banner headlines, would quote Rizzo's blood-chilling description of the plot, miraculously aborted, and the closeness of the city's escape from destruction. Bail would be set at astronomical levels, but prosecution of the culprits usually faltered. After long delays, months and even years, the back pages of the newspapers, whose front pages had originally blazed with reports of the sensational arrests, would limply report that the prosecution had been dropped altogether, or the defendants pled guilty to lesser charges, usually possession of weapons, or other unrelated charges. Unquote. The Philadelphia branch of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, was destroyed by just such a dynamite plot, as was the Revolutionary Action Movement, and, after several such raids, the Philadelphia chapter of the Black Panther Party. COINTELPRO, the FBI's greatest hits. The Black Panthers bear the uneasy distinction of being the most targeted organization of the late 1960s, perhaps the most targeted organization of all American history. The Panthers were persecuted, there's no other word, by a campaign codenamed COINTELPRO for Counterintelligence Program. COINTELPRO was explicitly designed, in the words of FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, quote, to expose, disrupt, misdirect, discredit, or otherwise neutralize the activities of black nationalist hate-type organizations and groupings, their leadership, spokesmen, membership, and supporters, and to counter their propensity for violence and civil disorder, unquote. The Church Committee offers more detail. COINTELPRO tactics included anonymously attacking the political beliefs of targets in order to induce their employers to fire them, anonymously mailing letters to spouses of intelligence targets for the purpose of destroying their marriages, obtaining from IRS the tax returns of a target, and then attempting to provoke an IRS investigation for the express purpose of deterring a protest leader from attending the Democratic National Convention, falsely and anonymously labeling as government informants members of groups known to be violent, thereby exposing the falsely labeled member to expulsion or physical attack. Pursuant to instructions to use misinformation to disrupt demonstrations, employing such means as broadcasting false orders on the same citizens' band radio frequency used by demonstration marshals to attempt to control demonstrations, and duplicating and falsely filling out forms soliciting housing for persons coming to a demonstration, thereby causing, quote, long and useless journeys to locate these addresses, unquote. The Church Committee report devotes a small section specifically to, quote, cooperation between the Federal Bureau of Investigation and local police departments in the disrupting the Black Panther Party, unquote. It details file-sharing practices involving the FBI and the police in San Diego, Oakland, Los Angeles, and Chicago, as well as FBI-instigated raids in San Diego and Chicago, and an FBI-directed disinformation campaign in Oakland. What the report doesn't say is that between December 1967 and December 1969, 28 Panthers were killed as a result of police attacks. It would require another book to consider all of these cases in detail, but a couple of examples may be quite telling. In Chicago, efforts to disrupt the Black Panther Party focused on a young leader named Fred Hampton. First, the FBI tried to trigger a feud between the Panthers and a local street gang, the Blackstone Rangers. FBI operatives sent Ranger leader Jeff Fort an anonymous letter claiming that Hampton had ordered his assassination. This tactic seems to have been selected in hopes of producing violence. The FBI memo describing it reads, quote, "It is believed that the letter may intensify the degree of animosity between the two groups and occasion Fort to take retaliatory action which could disrupt the BPP or lead to reprisals against its leadership. Consideration has been given to a similar letter to the BPP alleging a Ranger plot against BPP leadership. However, it is not felt that this would be productive principally because the BPP is not believed to be as violence-prone as the Rangers, to whom violent-type activity, shooting and the like, is second nature." Unquote. When the letter failed to produce the desired results, the FBI moved on to more direct means of neutralizing Hampton. On the morning of December 4, 1969, at 4 a.m., 14 police armed with submachine guns literally shot their way into Hampton's apartment. The police fired 98 rounds, killing Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, head of Peoria, Illinois BPP, and injuring three others. Only a single round of fire was returned, by Clark as he died. Hampton was shot five times, three times in the chest, then twice in the head. The raid had been planned a few weeks before by COINTELPRO operative Roy Mitchell and two cops assigned to a special unit under the direction of State's Attorney Edward V. Hanrahan. Mitchell had met with Hampton's bodyguard, William O'Neill, and received from him a detailed floor plan of the apartment, including the location of Hampton's bed. He also arranged for O'Neill to drug Hampton with a barbiturate on the night in question. A week after the raid, Robert Piper, the Chicago COINTELPRO section head, requested a $300 bonus for O'Neill. In this case, we see the local police, under the direction of the FBI, serving as nothing other than a death squad. 4 days after the Chicago raid, 40 SWAT officers and more than 100 backups launched a similar attack in Los Angeles, under the leadership of Red Squad Detective Ray Callahan, and again working from a floor plan provided by an FBI informant. The police began their offensive at 5:30 in the morning. This time, however, the target, Panther leader Elmer Geronimo Pratt, was not in his bed. The opening burst of gunfire missed him altogether. The Panthers held the police off until the media arrived and a crowd had formed. Then they surrendered. 6 were wounded and 13 arrested, but no one was killed. The raid was a dud, but the campaign against Pratt continued, eventually resulting in his arrest for the 1968 robbery and murder of Caroline Olson in Los Angeles. Pratt maintained that he was at a Black Panther Party meeting in Oakland when the crime was committed, a fact verified by other testimony. The defense sought to support the alibi with the FBI's phone tap records, but the feds wouldn't cooperate. They first denied that the telephone at the Oakland BPP office was tapped, then admitted that it was, but refused to turn over the records on national security grounds, and finally produced the records, except for those from the period relevant to the murder case, which they claimed were lost. Pratt was convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison. The conviction rested on the testimony of Julius Butler, a former party member who claimed that Pratt admitted to the murder. The prosecutor failed to mention that his key witness was on the police payroll, and Butler vehemently denied it under oath, saying he'd, quote, never been in all the world a snitch, unquote. Years later, documents surfaced identifying Butler as a paid informant for the FBI, LAPD, and District Attorney's Office. Furthermore, an FBI report from June 1970 frankly admitted the Bureau's interest in Pratt. Quote, constant consideration is given to the possibility of utilization of counterintelligence measures, with effort being directed toward neutralizing Pratt as an effective BPP functionary, unquote. After years of legal delays, in 1997, a conservative Reagan-appointed judge, Everett W. Dickey, overturned Pratt's conviction. Pratt, now going under the name Geronimo G. Jaga, spent 27 years as a political prisoner, nearly a third of that time in solitary confinement. Beyond COINTELPRO. COINTELPRO was only one aspect of the relationship between local Red Squads and the federal government. Beginning in 1968, the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration supplied grants to intelligence units for training and equipment. At about this same time, the Justice Department's Interdivisional Information Unit, IDIU, provided the means for intelligence agencies at all levels and from around the country to share information. According to the Church Report, this established a system through which, quote, the Attorney General received the benefits of information gathered by numerous agencies, without setting limits to intelligence reporting or providing clear policy guidance. Each component of the structure, FBI, Army, IDIU, local police, and many others, set its own generalized standards and priorities, resulting in excessive collection of information about law-abiding citizens, unquote. Nor was this the extent of federal involvement. Throughout the late 1960s, New York City's Red Squad gave daily briefings to Army intelligence. In Chicago, the U.S. Army Region 1, 113th Military Intelligence Group, not only trained and traded information with the local police, but participated in interrogations. Never willing to be left out of the action, the CIA offered a 6-week training course for local law enforcement personnel, teaching cops the basis of surreptitious entry, photographic surveillance, electronic eavesdropping, and the manufacture and use of explosives. Members of at least 44 state, county, and municipal police departments received this training, and in return, the locals helped the agency gather information, protect informants, and harass its critics. Since the practices of local cops inevitably came to resemble those of organizations that trained, funded, supplied, and directed them, it's worth considering the conduct of these federal agencies. The Church Committee summed it up, quote, too many people have been spied upon by too many government agencies, and too much information has been collected. The government has often undertaken the secret surveillance of citizens on the basis of their political beliefs, even when these beliefs pose no threat of violence or illegal acts on behalf of a hostile foreign power. The government, operating primarily through secret informants, but also using other intrusive techniques such as wiretaps, microphone bugs, surreptitious mail opening, and break-ins, has swept in vast amounts of information about the personal lives, views, and associations of American citizens. Investigations of groups deemed potentially dangerous, and even of groups suspected of associating with potentially dangerous organizations, have continued for decades, despite the fact that these groups did not engage in unlawful activity. Groups and individuals have been harassed and disrupted because of their political views and their lifestyles. Investigations have been based upon vague standards whose breadth made excessive collection inevitable. Unsavory and vicious tactics have been employed, including anonymous attempts to break up marriages, disrupt meetings, ostracize persons from their professions, and provoke target groups into rivalries that might result in deaths. Intelligence agencies have served the political and personal objectives of presidents and other high officials. While the agencies often committed excesses in response to pressure from high officials in the executive branch and Congress, they also occasionally initiated improper activities and then concealed them from officials whom they had the duty to inform. Unquote. With this in view, the political operations touched on here and the abuses that accompanied them cannot be dismissed as the excesses of individual overzealous officers, or even as the dysfunctions of particular departments. Instead, they should be understood as systemic in nature, institutional in scope, affecting the entire country, and, despite their purported aims, undermining democracy. This is certainly true of the most flagrant abuses, but it may also be true of legitimate intelligence operations. However restrained, intelligence activities function to suppress dissent and undercut basic political liberties. Yale University law professor Thomas Emerson explains, quote, "The very process of investigating political activities involving the questioning of friends, neighbors, employers, and other government agents is intimidating. The compiling of dossiers, which may be the basis of internment in the event of emergency or other reprisals, is threatening. The very existence of agents, informers, and possible agents provocateurs is chilling. Opportunities for partisan abuse of intelligence powers become available and tempting. Freedom of expression cannot exist under these conditions." Unquote. Secret police are always the enemies of democracy. Looking at the left, at every level of government, campaigns against dissent have tended to focus disproportionately on the activities of the left. In 1975, a former detective leaked to the press a list of organizations with files maintained by the Baltimore Police Department's Inspectional Service Division. 3 of 125 groups listed were classified as right-wing. Other categories included, quote, "subversive, extremist, civil rights, left-wing, pacifist, miscellaneous, and civic," unquote. The NAACP, the ACLU, the American Friends Service Committee, and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference all had files, as did a tenants group and a tutoring program. A similar list was leaked to the Citizens Commission on Police Repression concerning LAPD surveillance activity during the year 1975. Of 200 organizations listed, 20 could be considered violent. 20 others were crossed off, suggesting that they had been removed from the surveillance roster. These were mostly conservative groups, beginning with the John Birch Society. Of the 160 remaining, the vast majority were liberal, leftist, or third world solidarity groups. Quote, "A numbered grading system from 1 to 6 classified the degree of dangerousness attributed to each organization. For example, Women's Strike for Peace and the World Peace Council were graded number 1. Communist or affiliated or sympathetic with the Communist Party. The Southern Christian Leadership Conference and the National Council of Churches were rated number 2. Public advocacy of social or political change through violence or law violation. In categories 3 and 4, violence-prone groups, we find the Klan and others. Category 5, participation in or advocacy of any activity intended to create disorder, included the National Organization for Women and the United Farm Workers of America. Category 6 was assigned to, among others, the Black Social Workers Union and the Pakistan-American Friendship League," unquote. Police in Portland, Oregon, likewise maintained secret files on elected officials, people attending political lectures, soup kitchens, a free dental clinic, daycare centers, food co-ops, a bicycle repair collective, and other community groups. A report on rape crisis centers reads, quote, We can expect that these safe houses and this hotline communication network will probably be used for movement of wanted fugitives in case of future terrorist attacks, unquote. The file South Africa Anti contained the birth dates, phone numbers, class schedules, and grades of six high school students who wrote letters against apartheid. The IRA file listed the names of hundreds of people who signed a petition against the mistreatment of political prisoners. The Cults file included the 1983 annual report of the First Unitarian Church. The file labeled Terrorism, MISC, Oregon, featured information on Physicians for Social Responsibility, the Portland State University Hispanic Student Union, and Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. Police suspicion of reformers and radicals was not simply a reflection of the level of activity on the left, nor was the left more prone to violence than the right. Instead, this pattern indicates a deeply ingrained ideological bias on the part of the police, especially intelligence sections. This bias has consistently found two complementary expressions, hostility to the left and alliance with the right. For this reason, Red Squad files have commonly been shared with right-wing groups. The Los Angeles police traded files with the Western Goals Foundation, an organization started by John Birch Society leader and former Congressman Larry McDonald, and Research West, a private organization funded by FBI agents. Similar arrangements existed throughout the 1960s in most large American cities, including New York, Philadelphia, Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland, Buffalo, and Birmingham. At times, these relationships went further, as police made use of right-wing paramilitary and vigilante groups to carry out campaigns of violence or dirty tricks. The Legion of Justice, for example, conducted a series of burglaries, beatings, and arson attacks on behalf of the Chicago Red Squad. Less spectacular, but nearly as disturbing, in 1980, New Hampshire State Police worked with a private pro-nuclear group headed by Lyndon LaRouche in order to infiltrate the anti-nuclear clamshell alliance. Corporate America also got in on the act. A 1974 lawsuit, Benkirk versus Michigan, revealed that Detroit Intelligence Unit had been sharing files with the Chrysler Corporation, in some cases recommending Chrysler fire employees with radical political views. Chrysler, for its part, provided the police with information on its workers and helped place informants among militants on the job. The left as a whole has certainly received more than its fair share of unwanted police attention, but the police give particular scrutiny to those who criticize them. In March 1978, the Coalition Against Police Abuse, CAPA, received a partial list of LAPD officers. CAPA's secretary, Georgia O'Dome, appeared on the list. CAPA and the Citizen Commission on Police Repression quietly circulated the list, and two more infiltrators were discovered. In Philadelphia, the police undertook a prolonged struggle against a community paper called the Free Press after it ran a series of articles detailing police abuses. Reporters were harassed, searched, arrested, beaten, and slandered in the police-friendly corporate media. Their apartments and cars were burglarized. Their employers and schools were pressured to fire them and withdraw scholarships. The Free Press only survived by seeking and receiving federal court protection. Obviously, the police have an institutional interest in defending themselves against criticism. But it is worth noting the extent to which they treat dissent of any sort, absolutely any pressure towards social change, with animosity. This hostility to dissent should be understood not simply in terms of individual conservatism, but as an institutional feature of the entire criminal justice system, and perhaps even of the state as a whole. Alan Wolfe explains, quote, "It is not so much that the state acts mechanistically, always moving to support one group and repress the other, as it is that a regularized bias exists in the operations of democratic state that tends to support the interests of the powerful against those who challenge them. Despite some variations, when the state acts in a liberal democratic society such as that of the United States, it acts in a biased fashion. It is partial to the dominant interests, hostile to those whose power is minimal. By nearly all of its actions, it reproduces a society in which some have power at the expense of others, and it moves to support the others only when their protests are so strong that the some stand to lose all they have gained. It follows that repression will similarly not be a neutral phenomenon, but will have a class bias. We can predict with good accuracy that when the state intervenes to repress an organization or an ideology, it will be a dissenting group representing relatively powerless people, that will be repressed and the interests upheld will be those of the powerful. Unquote. Two natural outgrowths of this bias are the criminalization of ideologies rather than behavior and the judgment of guilt based on association. These in turn are each bound up with the police efforts to prevent unrest rather than simply responding to it. For example, Detective Sergeant John Ungveri, the head of the Cleveland Red Squad, told a Senate committee, quote, "If we had a law whereby we can charge all of them, black nationalists, as participants or conspirators, it would be far better than waiting for an overt act," unquote. As the police attempt to prevent unrest, assumptions about dissenting organizations' aims come to stand in for evidence of any individual guilt. This attitude and the activity it inspires creates a chilling effect that harms not only those groups actually under attack, but any group that fears similar treatment. And that is the end of the first part of Chapter 7.